plate a potential nugget.
Katie, the other piece I found fascinating in the book is, I think you referred to Max Bazeman, your dissertation advisor, and you actually talk about the nuance with which he dealt with the students. And you actually link it to another piece of research from Kellogg. Could you talk a little bit about the nuance here, about how we should focus on building confidence rather than, you know, pointing out mistakes people make?
Yeah, absolutely. I love that you gave me the chance to talk about this. I had the great good fortune to be advised by Max Bazeman as a PhD student. He's an amazing professor at Harvard Business School, and he is a sort of unusually talented advisor. His students have done unusually well in their careers. And I always wondered what that formula was. Like, what was his secret? How did he take so many students and generate so much success? I was really interested in it. Actually, when I started advising my own students as a faculty member at Wharton, what was it that Max did to succeed that was different than so many other advisors? And what I think I learned from both talking to Max and sort of exploring my own experience and actually reading research is something that I don't think Max appreciated he did, perhaps. So I tell the story of a time when I walked into Max's office after getting a rejection from a journal, which is like the worst thing that can happen to an academic, especially a junior one who's trying to figure out how to publish. It's publish or perish. And this, you know, work I had done, I poured my soul into for 2 years, had come back with reviews from all these people who are experts in my field saying rejected, it's not worth publishing. And I thought, you know, the end is near. And Max just gave me with total confidence the advice that this was going to, it was good work. It was going to turn out well. It was going to get into another journal. Go revise it for a couple days, do what I could, and let's send it back out again. And, not to panic, basically, which of course it's great advice. We all appreciate hearing not to panic. But what I realized is there's something really systematic about the way he handled anxiety, the way he coached his students to succeed, that was really actually kind of different than other advisors. He had this total faith that his students would succeed. He really believed in us in a way that was, I think, different than most advisors. And maybe most advisors do believe in their students, but maybe they don't always convey consistently, like, you are doing great. Here's how you're succeeding. Here's what you're doing right. And Max had an uncanny ability to do this. It all sort of became clearer to me years later when I learned about the research of Lauren Eskris Winkler, who's now a professor at the Kellogg School, as you alluded to. She had this insight doing her PhD research that more often than not, when someone comes to us and they're struggling, our instinct is to give them advice. And of course, an advisor is the person who most often is asked to give advice. So it's sort of funny that I'm pairing this with Max. What Lauren wondered is if we maybe had the formula wrong. And if instead of always giving advice when people come to us and tell us about their struggles and aren't soliciting advice, maybe we should actually do something different to build their confidence. Maybe we should turn the script around and we should ask them for advice, put them in the role of mentor and coach and see if that could help them. And she thought it might be effective to turn people who are trying to achieve more into advice givers for a few reasons. One is she thought it would build their confidence. And that's the most important reason, right? Most of the time they're used to being told they don't know what they're talking about. You know, this is why you're failing. Let me give you my tips. And that just depresses confidence. But if we put them on a pedestal and said, I actually think you probably have some insights from struggling with this challenge, maybe you could share them with others who are facing similar challenges and help them. We'd say, hey, we believe in you, that you are smart, that you can figure this out, that you already have some things to share and can help other people. So that's going to build their confidence, which often is deflated at this point in a challenge to change. That a second thing that it might do is help them dredge up insights they might not have even bothered to go looking for if they didn't have to give advice to someone else. And finally, once they say, oh, you should do this, they're going to start believing it. There's something called the saying is believing effect. If you say something to someone else, you don't want to be hypocritical, and you start to sort of think that must be true, or else why would I have said it? And you don't want to deviate from your own advice. So I link this to Max again, because one of the things I realized he did with all of his students is he put us in the position of advice giver to his more junior students. So there was sort of a group of us. And not only did he try to coach us when we asked for solicited advice, he actually very rarely gave unsolicited advice. And often his first step is to put you in the role of mentoring someone else, whether it was an undergraduate or a more junior student on a project. So there's sort of a coach opportunity for you as a doctoral student to learn how to be a leader and how to give other people advice. So I think he implemented this in practice. And then Lauren's research has proven in a number of different situations just how beneficial it is to be put in the role of advice giver. And one study that I got to collaborate on, we randomly assigned high school students to either give advice on studying and how to study more effectively to their younger peers, or just to a control condition where they go about life as usual. And what we found is that being randomly assigned to just spend about 10 minutes writing out bits of advice for other students, here's how, you know, here are good places to study, here's how you can avoid the temptation to check your phone constantly and stay focused, writing out that advice at the beginning of the third quarter of the academic year significantly improves students' grades in the class they most hope to improve in, as well as in math, over and above a control group that just didn't do this 10-minute exercise. And, you know, we weren't turning C students into valedictorians. It was a small boost in grades, but it was significant. And I think that's just, you know, testament to how powerful this tool can be of turning people into an advice giver rather than constantly just putting our arm around them and trying to coach them once we understand that it builds confidence.
Got it. And it's so counterintuitive, right? Typically when people mess up and come to you for advice, we sort of, it's very easy or tempting to jump into the position of problem solving and ideas giving. But I found this insight powerful and counterintuitive at the same time.
Yeah, no, I really love this insight. And I do, you know, I do want to point out, it does not say we shouldn't give solicited advice, right? When I walked into my advisor, Max, the great Max Bazerman's office, I solicited advice. What do I do about this manuscript? But, and he was helpful to say, we're going to resubmit it. But it's pointing out that sometimes when you give unsolicited advice, it can harm confidence. And that just in general, when we're coaching and helping people, how important it is to keep confidence in mind, and how we are, through our actions, whether we realize it or not, in every bit of coaching we give them, everything we say to them, it can implicitly convey whether we believe they've got what it takes or not. And it's so important to build people's confidence in order to help them achieve more.
I want to link this back to the insight from James Clear, who was at the podcast a while back. He speaks about how our identity plays a role in the way we build new habits or respond to change.
Every action you take is like a vote for the type of person you want to become. And so, you know, in a sense, your habits are how you embody a particular identity. Like every time that you make your bed, you embody the identity of someone who's clean and organized. Every time that you make a healthy meal and cook that at home rather than eating out, you embody the identity of someone who is focused on eating healthy. Every time that you write one sentence, you embody the identity of a writer. And no, those little actions, those tiny habits do not radically transform your body overnight. They don't lead to a written book in a single day, but they do cast a vote for being that kind of person. And so early on, that's really powerful because those habits provide evidence of this new identity. They give you a reason to root that belief in something. And so it can be a very powerful thing to adopt a new identity. It can be very powerful to look at yourself in this new light. And habits, I think, are the best path to doing that. But years down the line, when it's time for another change or another upgrade, you also have to be willing to repeat the cycle again and continue to grow and evolve.
A similar insight came up in my conversation with Alan Eagle about Bill Campbell, popularly known as the Trillion Dollar Coach, who often acted as a cheerleader for the leaders in Google. If I reflect on my personal experience, I had something very similar happen to me when I was at IIM Ahmedabad. I used to like courses in operations management, and one of the professors in that department was Professor Kannan Sethuraman. He'd done his PhD in Wharton and was teaching us at IMA. And he was like a breath of fresh air in the way he approached the class. I remember that he would treat us all like adults, and there was a healthy climate of discussion in the classroom, while with a lot of other professors, there would often be a climate of fear. I was doing quite well in that elective course, but for one of the projects I remember, I didn't have a lot of time to put in a good quality piece of work because of competing deadlines, and I ended up doing some cut-paste and submitting a shoddy job. I got an email from him summoning me to his office one day, and I was sure that I would get the dressing down of my life. But when I went there, I still remember he looked at me in the eye and said, "Deepak, I think you're capable of better work. This is not you. I'm extending the deadline for the whole class by a week, and I want you to send in work that would make you proud. That's it. Nothing more, nothing less." And when I look back, I think that made all the difference. I remember I did well in the course eventually. And coming back to Katie Milkman's insight, I feel that sometimes when people come to us for help, it's important for us to reinforce their positive identity rather than further batter them with more critique. Very often they are smart enough to figure out the answer themselves if they believe in themselves. Thank you for listening. For more, please visit playtopotential.com.